Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the alarming possibility that the brutal and unconstrained Saudi Crown Prince MBS will get away with a gruesome murder that shocked the world because the corrupt Turkish dictator Erdogan, who may or may not have the evidence of what happened inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, is so easily bribed. David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and author of An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship, joins us to discuss his article at the Globe Post, U.S. Needs Strategic Balance in Dealing with Saudi Arabia and Iran, and how Erdogan is likely to line his pockets rather than reveal the evidence of MBS's guilt, which he has been dribbling out. And although there are reports that Erdogan is trying to talk King Salman into not having MBS ascend to the Saudi throne, the likelihood is that this reckless, ignorant young leader will be around for decades, causing a lot more chaos than the disastrous record so far in his short tenure as Crown Prince. But with America led by a venal and callous president and his sycophantic Secretary of State, along with our own wrecking ball, John Bolton, the kind of strategic balance in the region between Saudi Arabia and Iran that David Phillips is calling for is not likely to come from this administration unless the American people rise up and vote these corrupt incompetents out of office. Then we will speak with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who writes on fascism, racism, authoritarian rulers, and propaganda. She joins us to discuss her article at CNN, Mail Bombs, Hate Speech Can Have Consequences, and we'll examine some historical parallels with the rise of Mussolini in the 1920s and the rise of political violence in America today under a president who has been inciting political violence throughout his campaign and presidency. We'll also assess whether Trump will resort to a Reichstag fire event to distract the public and inflame his base prior to the election. Then finally, we'll look into the latest surge of demonization of immigrants as a threat to U.S. national security from Trump, who is unleashing shameless demagoguery at the caravan of migrants heading north from Central America to our southern border, where Trump has now deployed the U.S. military. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and filmmaker Jose Antonio Vargas joins us to discuss his new book just out, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen, and what it is like living in the shadows with no fixed address while being subject to deportation at any moment. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Human Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He is a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and his latest book is An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship, and he has an article at the Globe Post, U.S. Needs Strategic Balance in Dealing with Saudi Arabia and Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be on the show.
So, David, there's obviously a game going on with Erdogan. He's hardly a champion for the free press, although he did apparently have some kind of personal relationship with the murdered Saudi dissident and Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But what do you think's going on with him? Is he angling for a bigger deal? My understanding is that he gave Gina Haspel, the head of the CIA, whatever evidence he has that he's keep teasing about. He shared that information with her. So I take it he talks to the Saudi king, but not to MBS, and that is his strategy to try and isolate MBS in the hope that the father will ditch his son, which I think is highly unlikely. What do you think?
His strategy, Ian, is to put as much money in his pocket as he can.
Uh-huh.
He's dribbling out information, implicating the Saudi prince in the hopes of extorting a larger payment from Saudi Arabia to destroy the audio and videotapes that he may have that implicate the Saudi team in the assassination. We know Tayyip Erdogan cares nothing about a free press or about human rights. He cares only about one thing, which is lining his pockets personally and extorting money from the kingdom so that Turkey can deal with its terrible financial crisis, a crisis of its own making, which is brought about by ineffective governance and corruption.
So then MBS is the perfect mark for Erdogan.
Couldn't be more convenient for Erdogan to have MBS in his sights. It's like the cash cow just walked into the living room, and now he's going to milk it for all it's worth.
So you don't think there's any geopolitical considerations of having to live with a psychotic young ruler who has a sense of impunity and has done some incredibly dangerous and rash things already? And if he's around for another 40 years, God help us. That doesn't come into the equation as far as Erdogan's concerned?
I'm sure it does to some extent. They're vying for influence in the Sunni Muslim world. Erdogan is a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood, whereas Saudi Arabia resists it because they see the brothers as a threat to the royal family. But the same criteria, qualities that you use to describe MBS, are the qualities that Erdogan possesses. So these two are cut out of the same cloth. They're really vying for supremacy in the Middle East and influence in the broader Sunni community.
And what about Qatar, where the Turks sent a military tripwire to stop MBS from invading? You recall that only 2 weeks after President Trump had his state visit to Saudi Arabia, the first of his state visits, where he did the sword dance, 2 weeks after that, MBS blockaded Qatar, and apparently he would have been happy to invade it. They want to shut down Al Jazeera more than anything else, but the Turks have some troops in there, and that deterred him. And I believe that the Qataris are trying to prop up Erdogan's devastated economy because of his incompetence and kleptocracy.
So not only does Turkey have a troop presence in Qatar, the U.S. fleet is also there. So we don't want Qatar and Saudi Arabia to end up in a live fire war. U.S. interests will be caught right in the middle. Yes, MBS did want to invade Qatar, and that's been par for the course. There's been a series of diplomatic tiffs, not only with Qatar, but also with Canada, that MBS has allowed to spiral out of control, much to the detriment of Saudi Arabia and its international relations. So MBS is a despot. He's an autocrat. He's a young man without any seasoned judgment. Having him in complete control of the kingdom for the next decades is threatening to the U.S. and to our and to other countries in the region, including Turkey, our NATO ally, who has run off the reservation.
And again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush and Obama, and his latest book is An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship. And he has an article at the Globe Post, U.S. Needs Strategic Balance in Dealing with Saudi Arabia and Iran. So is this message in any way getting to Donald Trump, or is he just because of him and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was so beguiled by their treatment? And apparently Jared Kushner has a personal relationship with MBS, and there's a lot of rumors about money changing hands.
So we don't know what messages get through to President Trump. Apparently, none of his senior staff is able to impress upon him important decisions. So we really have no way of knowing. We have seen that Trump is mercurial in his approach to Saudi Arabia. It vacillates from day to day. It seems that the last person he spoke to left an impression on him. Is reflected in Trump's comments. So we don't really know what the U.S. policy is, except that the U.S. wants to sell military equipment to Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis have promised to buy $110 billion worth of hardware from Raytheon and others. Blackstone is supposed to receive a $20 billion investment for its private equity fund, and the Saudis purchase $20 billion worth of U.S. goods each year. So the relationship with Saudi Arabia isn't based on democracy or human rights or shared values. Trump's relationship with the Saudis is entirely transactional. It's contingent upon how much money the Saudis can shovel to the U.S. concerns, ultimately reflecting on Trump's performance.
Well, we know that Jared shook down the former Soviet ambassador Kislyak in a meeting with Putin's banker, at which he asked for a back channel between Trump and the Kremlin, and then he asked for $500 million to bail out his property at 666 Fifth Avenue. It's been underwater since he bought it to impress Ivanka when he was courting her. But on the case of Trump himself, he's made it clear that he has no concerns about human rights. From the day one, he dismissed Khashoggi as he's not an American citizen. You're perfectly free to decapitate anybody who's not an American citizen. But more recently, when he was asked about the Saudis and their cover story, he used a strange word. He said it was a bad concept from the beginning and that it was a terrible, terrible cover-up. He was almost saying that they should have done a better job of disposing of this guy and implying that he would have done better. I mean, that's the way I interpret it. How did it strike you?
Yeah, it sounded an awful lot like that. If they'd contracted with the Trump Organization, the Saudis might have shown a little bit more expertise, a little bit more deft hand in managing the problem. The Saudis have been incredibly tone-deaf, changing their story from day to day, not fully disclosing or being transparent about what happened. Instead of pressing them for greater transparency, the Trump administration has run interference for them, accepting their alibis, trying to justify the lies from Riyadh. It doesn't show the kind of principled foreign policy on an important matter you'd expect from the United States, but it is exactly what you'd expect from President Trump, who cares not about the security alliance or America's reputation around the world, but cares solely about how much money can be deposited from Saudi accounts into U.S. accounts to make the economy of the United States look stronger.
Well, back to the Turks and the extent to which Erdogan is angling for a deal, and he's been teasing about this tape recordings of what happened inside the consulate. Some of the details that have come out, and Gina Haspel, the head of the CIA, did meet with him, and she supposedly was given access to the recordings, whether they're audio, video, or both. Some of the stuff that's been leaked out does sort of ring true. The latest I'd heard is that when he went into the consulate, Khashoggi was directed to the consul's office. When he got inside the consul's office, he was grabbed. They started to cut his fingers off, and in the consul's office, the consul said, "Please don't do it in here." And I think it was a Tiber or one of the two henchmen that are close to MBS said to the consul, "Shut up. Or, we'll send you back to Saudi Arabia." And then there was a phone call one of the henchmen got from MBS that was supposedly intercepted where he's saying, "Cut off the head of the dog." And the rumor is that they decapitated him and the body was disposed of somewhere in the woods or somewhere. And the head was sent back in a diplomatic pouch to MBS. So you're saying that none of this information may be accurate. It may just be what Erdogan's teasing out. But at some point, you'd think he'd have to have some basis. I mean, obviously something terrible happened there, right? And we still haven't seen the body.
So we don't know what information exists, what's accurate and what isn't. If MBS was on the phone to his hit team telling them to decapitate Khashoggi, then clearly he's directly involved in the crime. And how can the United States government do business with somebody who is a murderer and a criminal? Gives us real pause about our policies in the Middle East, about our reliance on Saudi Arabia for the Middle East peace process, and whether or not we should be isolating Iran with Saudi Arabia's help as part of the process of canceling the Iran nuclear deal. Shouldn't we have a more balanced approach between Saudi Arabia and Iran so that we could work with both countries on regional and international problems? I think in Yemen and elsewhere, clearly the answer is yes.
Well, do you think that this outrage, even if the full details don't come out, it's so obvious, I think any reasonable person could see that the MBS is implicated in this, whether he has directly has blood on his hands, or it's more of a case of Henry the Fourth saying, "Will someone rid me of this troublesome priest?" The long and the short of it is that nobody believes that he's innocent of either being the author of this assassination or somebody who's encouraged it in that kind of way that gives him some kind of distance. Do you think the Senate, there have been rumblings about stopping the U.S. cooperation with MBS in Yemen? The port of Hodeidah is under siege, horrendous stuff. There's been more bombings there recently. More civilians have been killed. People are starving. Half the country of Yemen is starving. So at what point do you think the Congress is going to step up and do the right thing?
Well, let's be clear about one thing. This kind of operation doesn't occur unless senior people in the Saudi government know about it and are coordinating it. There is no such thing as a rogue unit that goes overseas with this kind of mandate operating outside of instructions from MBS. Should the U.S. review its support to Saudi Arabia, which has been bombing school buses and hospitals in Yemen? Of course we should. We shouldn't wait for this incident to have a complete policy review about our position in Yemen. Instead of choosing sides, we should be trying to mediate differences, bring in a humanitarian pause to the conflict, and use the humanitarian pause as a launch point for real negotiations to divide power between the different regions in Yemen so that this terrible civil war that's killed more than 10,000 people senselessly, needlessly, can come to an end. It shouldn't be based on our review of Saudi Arabia after the Khashoggi incident. It should be based on human rights principles and what we stand for and want to achieve in the world.
But if our president is, as he appears to be, an ego-driven, ignorant thug who only cares about enriching himself and has no human values, at least that he exhibits. And now, of course, he's saying we all should be nice to each other after he's trashed everybody, and the people he's trashed the most are the ones that have been sent pipe bombs. So that's him. But his closest advisors, the Secretary of State, seems like a total sycophant. Bolton seems to be, as much as people are alarmed about him, it's even worse when he's exercising the power of National Security Council head. I mean, pulling out of the INF is just crazy, and I don't expect anything from these people except really bad choices and terrible and dangerous decisions. So where's the pressure going to come from?
So the pressure is going to come from the Congress. Right now, both the Senate and the House are controlled by Republicans. That's why we see no oversight coming from Capitol Hill. If the Democrats are able to take control of one chamber or the other, then they're going to have the power to convene hearings, the power of subpoena. The whole basis of our Constitution is rooted on balance of powers and oversight. We can't allow the presidency, the judiciary, and the Congress to be controlled by one party. Otherwise, we see an abuse of powers, and that's exactly what's been going on. That's why these midterm elections are so crucial. The Democrats have a real chance of winning back the House. It's important that people go door to door and that they vote. If their voices aren't heard, then the U.S. is going to continue to be a force in the world against the kinds of American values and principles that most Americans hold dear.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, it's always good to be on the show and to talk with you.
Thank you. And I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship. And he has an article at the Globe Post, U.S. Needs Strategic Balance in Dealing with Saudi Arabia and Iran. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the rise of political violence in America today under a president who has been inciting political violence throughout his campaign and presidency.
not cause things the same, but cause we lack the same color, and that's gray. Now that's May, can't burn his cross, cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman strapped with a bomb on the bus, with the seconds running, give you the jitters. Just imagine an American-based Christian organization planning the poison water supplies to bring the second coming quicker.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. And she has an article at CNN, Mail Bombs, Hate Speech Can Have Consequences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Thank you so much.
And Ruth, before we get to your article, did you catch the piece in the New York Times a couple of days ago by Alexander Stiller, the Italian scholar? I imagine
yes.
Your colleagues. What did you think of it? Because I think it was very thoughtful and quite subtle, but it did sort of resonate about what's happening now.
Yes, that when dictators are threatened, they will, or want to be dictators, more to the point, they will stop at nothing, even murder, to silence their critics. This article was about Mussolini, who was not yet dictator. He was a president, prime minister in a democracy, and he had his fiercest critic, the head of the Socialist Party, Matteotti, was his last name, murdered. And the New York Times article was speaking with it, about it in reference to the Khashoggi killing. I had actually done an article some months ago on the same subject of the Matteotti killing for the Washington Post, talking about how Mussolini killed Matteotti to avoid being investigated by, you know, prosecutors. So there are many, many parallels between what Mussolini did when he was trying to escape prosecution and escape blame when he was not yet a dictator that we can learn from.
Well, it's not an exact example,
no.
But it does have some resonance in the sense that just recently in your city, Manhattan, at the Republican Club, they hosted the head of the Proud Boys. And the event was the celebration of the assassination by samurai sword of the head of the Japanese Socialist Party in the 1960s. And the head of the Proud Boys, McGinnis, showed up with a samurai sword. And then after he gave his speech to the New York Republicans, it is the headquarters of the New York Republican Party, the Metropolitan Republican Club, the Proud Boys went outside and beat up some Antifa protesters. So I know it's not on the level of what we're talking about happened in the 1920s in Italy, but there are some similarities, aren't there?
There are. And one of the main dynamics that helps authoritarian rulers is to create a situation of extreme polarization in society where the two sides can't talk to each other, where there's a lot of violence, where there's a lot of uncertainty about what truth is. And all of this helps the leader on the rise because people look to him to come in as a strong force to calm things down, or he's able to act forcefully, sometimes with martial law or rule by decree, in order to, quote, restore order. The trick is that often it's the same people who want to restore order who have created the violence.
Yeah, that's the old arsonist is the fire brigade, right? So, but in your article, you really go back into Trump's recent history, both on the campaign and in his presidency. And when you think back at some of the stuff you mentioned, for example, when he talked about Second Amendment people acting against Clinton, there was no doubt what he was doing there. And more recently, of course, exalting Gianforte for body slamming a Guardian reporter who was subsequently beaten up. And he's beaten up so savagely, his glasses were broken. And Gianforte pled guilty and had to pay a fine. There's no point in even giving our audience any more examples because we've been watching this from day one. This is an extraordinary situation to have a president. The thing that most offended me, by the way, Ruth, it just happened a couple of days ago when he complained about how inept the Saudis were. He said they had a bad concept in murdering and decapitating in Khashoggi. It was a bad concept, and that it was a terrible cover-up. he was more or less saying, you know, I would have done it better. And, you know, he wasn't complaining about it as a gross violation of human rights happening in a consulate, for God's sake, in a foreign country. But it was mostly a complaint about how they didn't do a good job.
No, and that's actually, I'm writing a book on strongmen, and I'm doing a deep dive into the personalities and the rise of a lot of these rulers. And one thing they have in common is that they are amoral. They believe that you have to do what you need to do to get ahead, and they have disdain for people who bungle it. Not that they tried, but that they failed. In fact, I'm writing right now on Francisco Franco, who used the civil war to emerge as a dictator. And I just this morning I found a quote from him saying that he was upset with a fellow military officer who was planning a coup, not because he tried to overthrow the government, but because he failed. So there's a certain strongman mentality that Trump shares 100%, unfortunately, that is more upset at things being covered up badly than at the crimes themselves.
And again, I'm speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. And she has an article at CNN, Mail Bombs, Hate Speech Can Have Consequences. So let's talk a bit about where we are now, because even since you wrote the article, Ruth, there have been two more mail bombs show up. One at a restaurant owned by Robert De Niro in Tribeca, the Tribeca Grill, and the bomb was removed by the New York bomb squad early this morning. And then Joe Biden, also the same package addressed to him, was intercepted. And the reason I think the De Niro's restaurant, the security person noticed that he'd seen pictures of the bubble wrap envelope that the bomb came into, all these other prominent Democrats, including two former U.S. presidents, he noticed them and therefore called the police. So if he would have opened them, there would have probably been an explosion. So this is a very serious matter. And I'm astounded at the behavior of Trump. He's not even called Obama, Hillary, or any of these people, particularly the two former presidents, to console them, you know, about what's happened. That's what presidents normally do. I'm just, you know, do you feel like we're all in the twilight zone here, that the rules of the whole rule book of the behavior of American leadership has just been thrown out?
Unfortunately, I don't feel we're in the twilight zone, because it's true that the Democratic leader playbook has been thrown out, but the authoritarian playbook is being used. And if you know that playbook, you are able to find almost nothing he does surprising. And he's not going to send them a condolence note or call. He, in fact, has doubled down on his attacks against the press, even though the press was one of the targets. He's been, if anything, more adamant about even retweeting recently insinuations that these were fake bombs and fake news, which is a whole other level of seriousness.
Well, that's what the right wing media and Fox and Breitbart and
that's right.
and Limbaugh, they're pushing that meme that this was a Democratic false flag operation. So he's even feeding that monstrosity.
Yeah, and what's going on now is the classic terrorist attack strategy, where you have simultaneous attempts at violence spread out over a large area in order to make it seem as though this terrorism is frightening to people because of its randomness. And here we have a coordinated high density attack strategy. And this is, the aim of terrorists is to destabilize society. And the right has often done this ahead of an important political event that is part of the Democratic playbook, i.e. elections. So this has everything to do with midterm elections coming up and very soon. But another point, which is the bigger picture, is we have all these Democratic politicians. We have CNN, which is viewed as liberal, long his target, and we have George Soros. The presence of Soros, as I wrote in my article, means that this is also a sign that the global right has a foothold in America. And you have politicians such as Steve King of Iowa who have made themselves liaisons between the American racist right and Putin and Geert Wilders, the very dangerous right in Europe, and including George Soros, who's been, a target of the right for, again, in Europe and here, one of their top enemies, means that it's not just a national anti-democratic party attack. There's something bigger going on.
And indeed, Orbán in Hungary is taking that country into an authoritarian direction. He's just succeeded in shutting down the university that George Soros underwrote in Hungary. Let me just quickly ask you, though, about this, because back to what you were saying a second ago. You're talking about provocation before elections. That's the Reichstag fire, isn't it? Isn't that the best example?
There is that. There's also the fact that Vladimir Putin, who Trump so admires, when he was trying but didn't have much success ahead to become president of Russia in 1999, there were bombings of apartment buildings in Moscow that killed 200 people, terrorist activities. And that was a causal event that allowed him, it also had to do with the Chechen War, he was able to become president. And so many people look back at those destabilizing bombings as a turning point in Putin's political fortunes. Basically, a lot of historians and analysts say he wasn't really going anywhere before the bombings, and after he was able to triumph. It's a bit more complicated than that, but that's another example. And in the history of authoritarian rulers, there's a lot of, some people call it luck, some people call it fortuitous events that they may or may not have had something to do with, but there's a lot of cases of destabilizing actions that help them rather than harm them.
Well, I don't think you can make the case, as some people are trying to do, that the equivalent of the Reichstag fire at the moment is this caravan of immigrants coming up from Central America. I've looked into it, and I think the charges that this fellow Fuentes has organized it don't really hold up. It just seems that Trump has just gotten lucky that this happened to happen at this moment. How do you see it, Ruth?
I agree with you, because there have been caravans in the past. The whole what is objectionable is that here, as in so many other cases, we are too quick to normalize the right language for things. And the idea of the caravan, is a kind of right-wing thing. And we end up repeating, partly because we continue to obtusely retreat Trump. We retreat a lot of just even to denigrate them. But in retweeting, we spread their language and we allow them to set the terms of the debate. So the caravan is this notion, it already conjures up something large scale. And so there have been lots of them, and this is the latest one, but we're at this point before the midterms where everything is extremely fiery and polarized.
I remember when Trump first came on the scene in the campaign, the Huffington Post decided not to cover him. He got $5.2 billion worth of free advertising from the mainstream press, who couldn't get enough of him. And they rather bravely, but rather, futilely, decided not to cover him. And after a while, they had to cover him. So how do you not fall into the trap that you just described?
Well, there's no one answer. I think some of the things that people do, and this is not TV, but Daniel Dale of the Toronto Star has been stalwart in pointing out, adding up, tallying Trump's lies. And you can never read an article by Daniel Dale, who is he covers Trump, without even on his rallies, he includes the lies right there in the coverage. It's harder for TV, but, you know, and there's a debate whether we should cover rallies or not. They're becoming very, very dangerous for journalists in them. And there's also an argument to make, like I study newsreels of rallies for Hitler and Mussolini, and if I didn't have those as a historical record, we would be losing something. On the other hand, you know, there have been suggestions that there's just one, you send one news, you know, organization to cover it and not all of them. So we're still, America's become a laboratory for how to deal with hate speech and how to deal with a president who is supporting hate speech. And so we're kind of trying to figure it out in real time and often perhaps not having the right instincts.
So it's not just supporting hate speech, he's propagating it. But just in the last couple of minutes, Ruth, is this going to work against him? I just keep, you know, there was a historian, Meacham, wrote a book, Invoking Our Better Angels. Our better angels will better show up in the, within, we've only got about 2 weeks for them to show up, right? Less than 2 weeks. So the question being, is this going to backfire on him?
No, it's not going to backfire on him. It's when you have this dynamic of these kind of charismatic leaders, it's things that most of us would think that would be the political death of them, they just shrug it off. And already his reaction to the Khashoggi killing, again, that's for his public, everything he's doing is welcomed. And everything he's saying is welcomed. And the problem is the Democrats have not, the Democratic Party machine doesn't seem to be allowing enough real challengers to come forth. And this is really a problem for 2020. It's too late for the midterms.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. And she has an article at CNN, Mail Bombs, Hate Speech Can Have Consequences. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and filmmaker and author of Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen.
Politics need votes. Politics needs your mind. Politics needs human beings. Politics needs lies. That's why.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There's no sickness, toil or danger. That bright land to which I go, I'm going there to see my mother.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jose Antonio Vargas, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, an Emmy-nominated filmmaker, and a leading voice for the human rights of immigrants. He is the founder and CEO of Define American, the nation's leading nonprofit media and cultural organization that fights injustice and anti-immigrant hate through the power of storytelling. He has worked as a reporter at the Washington Post, the Huffington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, and other leading publications, and have written stories for the New York Times Magazine and Time, and his work has appeared in Rolling Stone and The New Yorker. In addition, he has produced and directed Documented, an autobiographical feature documentary that aired on CNN, and White People, an hour-long MTV special on what it means to be young and white in a changing America. Currently, he's subject to deportation at any time, and he has no permanent residence. And his latest book just out is Dear America, Notes from an Undocumented Citizen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jose Antonio Vargas.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Jose, obviously at this moment, much of the political attention is focused on a caravan coming north from the southern border of Mexico, and the president is obviously in a fact-free zone. He's able to say anything he likes, make stuff up. And as we're 2 weeks away from an election, apparently the polls are shifting in the Republicans' favor. This blue wave may turn out to be a ripple. So since you're living in the shadows and in the embodiment of all that's wrong and dysfunctional about our immigration policy or the lack thereof, how do you see this political moment?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that's why I, 7 years ago, I started Define American, because I didn't want to live in the shadows anymore, right? Because I think in many ways, if anything, I think this government, specifically this administration, is really hiding not only from the facts, but from what the issue even really is. I don't think it's a surprise, by the way, that, you know, the story right now is this caravan and the fact that the president is mixing Middle Easterners with all of these, you know, quote-unquote people coming from the southern border. This exact narrative happened just a few months ago, and actually it happened before the election in 2016. So I don't think, you know, I don't think none of this is a coincidence. I think this is an effort by a very organized and very disciplined kind of anti-immigrant machine that used to be on the fringes that is now running the White House.
Well, I don't know whether this is conspiratorial, but I've been getting mail from listeners asking me to look into whether or not there is some financial chicanery going on. As we know, President Trump does projection in a psychological sense. He accuses, for example, Hillary Clinton of being a criminal when there's an enormous amount of evidence that he has consorted with criminals for most of his adult life and that his business success may be due to laundering money for the Russian mob and the KGB. So when he blames, as he does in these rallies, George Soros for financing this caravan, inquiring minds want to know whether maybe his friend Adelson is financing the caravan.
I don't think this is a coincidence. I think, especially knowing what we know now in terms of, you know, more information happening that we've gathered around what happened in 2016. To me, the question, though, is who falls for it and why are they falling for it? Right? That's right. The question. Like, what is this? I mean, you know, when I wrote my book, like, part of what I've been thinking about is, like, what I was thinking about is, how do I paint a picture in terms of what the master narrative of immigration has been in this country, right? And really kind of get away from not just the politics and the policies of it, but all this language that we use that in many ways doesn't really reflect the reality of people's lives, right? Hmm. Like, what are we afraid of exactly?
Well, I think in the broadest sense, what white people are afraid of, and that's certainly, I'm not suggesting all white people, but the people who support Trump, the base, as it's referred to, I think that it comes down to the fact that we are in a time when being simply born white no longer confers automatic privilege. And I think a lot of people have a hard time dealing with that.
And, you know, and absolutely, as you said, I mean, this is why I made white people a few years ago, right? But also, I mean, I remember exit polls showing right after the election that at least 20 to 30% of Latinos voted for Trump, right? Mm-hmm. I think the Asian community is, you know, I don't know, I'm Filipino. I don't know exactly what the split is, but I know from my own family that Filipino Americans were the highest percentage of Asian groups that voted for Trump. So it is not only white people, but it's like this whiteness as ideology, mm-hmm. right? Which to me is what the Trump administration represents, is whiteness as kind of a belief, and as a way of thinking of yourself as the default, as the norm, as the center, and everybody else has to be explained and has to be feared.
You know? Well, This is, you know, this is the paradox, isn't it? We celebrate ourselves, or a lot of people celebrate the country as a nation of immigrants and the Statue of Liberty, et cetera. But we've had
I mean, I think that's, I mean, I would argue, right, and I'm arguing this as a student of American history. I was lucky enough to have gone to a high school in the Bay Area in California where our textbook, our U.S. history textbook, was Howard Zinn, right? That was the assigned text, was the People's History of the United States. I'll never forget when I got to the Washington Post as a reporter, and people, you know, I told people that I came from Mountain View and that was my textbook. People thought I was a communist or something. Like, are you from the left? Are you radical? I'm like, no, that was the history book. I would argue that what we're living through right now are all the lies and the delusions and the myths that we've told ourselves about who we are. I mean, even that statement of a country built by immigrants, like we leave off two groups of people when we say that, right? We leave off Native Americans and we leave off African Americans who are forced to come here. So all of these myths that we've told about ourselves, and even the reality, for example, the fastest growing undocumented population in America are coming from Asia, not from Latin America, certainly not from Mexico, right? Mm-hmm. And yet I would argue that most journalists probably don't even know that. Because the narrative on immigration has always been about Latinos. It's always been about the border south of us. Never the border on top of us, by the way. Never the border that is the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, right, when it comes to people overstaying their visas and coming here.
And again, I'm speaking with Jose Antonio Vargas, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and Emmy-nominated filmmaker and a leading voice for the human rights of immigrants. He's the founder and CEO of Define American, and he's produced and directed, documented, an autobiographical feature documentary that aired on CNN and White People in an hour-long MTV special on what it means to be young and white in a changing America. He's currently subject to deportation at any time, and he has no permanent residence, and his latest book just out is Dear Citizens, Notes from an Undocumented Citizen. But there have been periods in this country where this anti-immigrant fervor that we're experiencing at the moment has emerged. And almost 100 years ago, you had the Know Nothing movement, which in many ways has echoes of the present. The Irish, of course, were the subject of the demonization back then, not the Mexicans and Central Americans. So I don't know whether, you know, I mean, I come from Australia, which has more than its share of racism as well. And, of course, Brexit in the UK, that passed largely because of xenophobia. It was actually financed by the Russians in many ways. And that was all about raising the specter of immigrants invading the UK. So it is a kind of – there's a massive global shift underway. And it will be exacerbated by global warming, which, of course, our president and the Republicans deny. What's your sense of how we can stop this infection of this delusion before it metastasizes?
Thank you for giving this a more global context, because I think that's really important. You know, when I wrote the dedication, part of the dedication is actually to the 258 million migrants in the world. According to the UN, there's 258 million people in the world right now who are moving. We are amidst the largest movement of people the world has ever seen. And as you said, climate change is about to exacerbate all of that. And I actually think coming up with a different, more accurate language around this is absolutely essential. So I would argue, you know, some of our colleagues in the news media call it, you know, a global migration crisis. Right? Well, that's from the perspective of white people who always got to call it what it is. I would argue that it's actually a natural progress of history. It's a human progression, right? So all those, you know, centuries ago that Western countries imperialized and colonized all these other countries, what did they think the impact of that was going to be? Right?
Well, I think they were just out for short-term gain, weren't they? Which is really the problem we have with this administration. There's no planning. There's no vision in Trump world. It's just, you know, rape and pillage and manipulate and lie.
And it's all these short, you know, kind of reactions to kind of what they're fearing without, again, and I would argue that this is bigger than the Trump administration, right? Because people voted for Trump. that didn't happen overnight. I mean, look at immigration, for example. You know, if immigration in this country has been a bipartisan mess. Both parties have been to blame. Like people like me, for example, if I were to leave this country, I would be I would face what's called a 10-year bar, right? And there would be no guarantee that I'd be allowed back. Well, that's because of the Clinton administration and what Clinton signed into law in the mid-1990s, right? And what from Clinton to Bush to Obama, now to Trump. So this didn't happen just overnight. And I think we have to examine it from that perspective and also make sure, as you pointed out, that we look at it from a global perspective. Why are people moving? What are the actual root causes of migration and why people have to move? You know, I mean, I think we have to really interrogate these questions. And unfortunately, we are so busy being distracted, right, not just by this president, by everything around us. You know, I mean, let's not forget, like, this is going to be a turnout game, this election. And in a midterm, turnout has not always been good for the Democrats. Why is that?
Well, the New York Times ran a piece a couple of days ago suggesting that the Latinos weren't going to vote in any significant numbers.
I thought that was actually, it's funny you said it. I literally emailed that piece to I don't know how many people and saying, look, this is a bigger problem. And not just Latinos, by the way. How about Asian people? You know, Asian people, Asian Americans are now the fastest growing immigrant group and the fastest growing racial group. Where do Asian people play a role into this? In the state of California, Asians and Latinos make up the majority.
Right. And you also said they were the fastest growing group of undocumented immigrants.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. And to me, you know, that's why when I wrote the book, I'm sure you know, the subtitle is Notes of an Undocumented Citizen, which is a nod to James Baldwin, whose influence on me has been, you know, tremendous since I was a kid. But I wanted to use the term citizen because I think that's actually what's at play here. Like, what does it mean to be a citizen? Look, I'm not a citizen by birth, right? And I'm not a citizen by paper or by law. I have to be a citizen of something else, which is a citizen of contribution. I have to engage. I have to contribute. I have to know that I'm a part of this society. And yet, there are many people in this country who are born in this country, who are naturalized citizens, who have the papers, who have made the choice to not engage.
Right, not vote.
What is the, and you know, many of them, by the way, are my relatives,
right,
who I like have to talk to every day. Like, are you registered to vote? You know that this is about to, you know, do you know where you can vote? But to a lot of people in this country, to a lot of people in the state of California, you know, America is just something you buy, something you wear, something you eat. It's not something you participate in.
So,
and I think that's a crisis. We are in a crisis of engagement, I would argue. And we have to know that, first of all, I mean, black people in this country, right? I mean, look, you wouldn't have the 1965 Immigration Act without the 1964 Civil Rights Act and 1964 Voting Rights Act, right? Like, so the immigrant rights movement in many ways is built on the struggle of black people and their white allies. And so, to me, the fact that black people had always put their lives out there in terms of civil disobedience and making sure that people are protesting and are engaging, what Colin Kaepernick is doing, you know, I think that serves as a real inspiration to us and must serve an inspiration to all of us, especially people who have come to this country post-1965.
But what would your explanation be or analysis be of that New York Times story we were talking about? Why do Latinos, aren't they, you know, this is a president who insulted them on the very first day, called them a bunch of rapists and murderers, and has been ripping Latino children from the arms of their parents at the southern border. You would think that would strike deeply at the heart of Latinos and motivate them to want to vote this guy out.
But, well, first of all, I mean, Latinos are not a monolithic group. As are not white people and black people and Asian people, right? Absolutely, this has been horrendous and, you know, just terrible what is happening. But you also have to recognize that when a group of people are hurting, right, like there's kind of an insularity that sets in, right? Like there was a study, for example, that showed that if you're a naturalized citizen or a U.S. citizen by birth, and you live with undocumented people in your family, in your household, you are less likely, right, to actually want to seek out citizenship because you're afraid that you might negatively impact your relatives at home, that you might accidentally out them, right?
Right.
So there's the fear even within households about that, which I thought was really interesting that I hadn't realized. Right. And so I think the trauma of all of this, and I think the fear that has become kind of stock in trade, has had really, you know, deep impact about how people in the Latino community see themselves and see their relationship, you know, with this government. I thought it was interesting in that New York Times article, some people, you know, said, well, you know, what's the difference? I'm not sure electing anyone makes a difference anymore. That kind of apathy,
right.
which is not what we have seen in the white community, and to some extent the black community that the Obama, you know, that the Obama era has really kind of really inspired, right? And that's not, that kind of apathy is not just isolated to the white community. That is totally within the immigrant community as well. You know, we're just here. I talked to my aunt after the election, one of my aunts who's a U.S. citizen who didn't vote, right? And she said, oh, why would it matter if I voted? We're just here to work, right? Meaning they've internalized that we're just labor.
Hmm. Well, it is mystifying and it's tragic. And the cynical version is that you get the government you deserve. And,
yeah, that is the cynical version, but I refuse. What did James Baldwin say? I cannot be a pessimist because I am alive. To be a pessimist means that life is nothing but an academic matter, so I have to be an optimist. So I have to think that every day. I have to be an optimist. I cannot succumb to either cynicism or pessimism. That's too easy.
Well, Jose Antonio Vargas, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jose Antonio Vargas, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, an Emmy-nominated filmmaker, and a leading voice for the human rights of immigrants. He's the founder and CEO of Define American, the nation's leading nonprofit media and cultural organization that fights injustice and anti-immigrant hate through the power of storytelling. He's worked as a reporter at the Washington Post, the Huffington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, and other leading publications, and he's written stories for the New York Times Magazine and Time, and his work has appeared in Rolling Stone and The New Yorker. In addition, he's produced and directed Documented, an autobiographical feature documentary that aired on CNN, and White People, an hour-long MTV special on what it means to be young and white in a changing America. And he's currently subject to deportation at any time, and so he has no permanent residence. And his latest book just out is Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.